Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is June 10th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everyone. As we did last week, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Neil.
I think you're still up in Maine. You just can't get enough of that good state. Is the weather getting hotter?
Yeah, it is getting hotter. It's like mid-70s, comfortable.
And even hotter still with the arrival of President Trump. I understand that the governor warned him to, stay away from his usual inflammatory rhetoric. I don't know. Maybe you are closer to that than anybody else.
Yes, he showed up, I think, last weekend. And what most people were reporting on was that Maine's Republican Senator Susan Collins was noticeably absent, and she has a tough re-election coming up in November.
Yeah, she does indeed.
So some are wondering if she's distancing herself.
I couldn't imagine why we should be doing that. Yeah, it's every man for himself and every woman for herself. So there we are. We're going to do another episode. Let me just remind everyone, as always, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about in this podcast, please consider subscribing to our research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together here with my team at Hedgeye Risk Management. You can just Google it and go there. And among other things, you'll get our newswire, our weekly show on COVID-19, special interviews with guests. And by the way, next week I'll be interviewing JT Taylor, who's director of Hedgeye's politics sector. He knows everything that's going on in Capitol Hill. And we're going to talk about, how does it look now for Trump? We're going to talk a bit later in this podcast about that, some of the changing projections. Suffice it to say, things don't quite look as good for the president right now. I think it's fair to say. So, as always, we have a incredibly ambitious agenda, and all I can say, Christian, is I hope we get to it all. We're gonna obviously start with markets, as we always do. U.S. indicators, was the employment rate, 3.5 or actually 19% in May? World indicators, not a lot here. I do know we have something to say about Germany and China. Stunning new projections by the OECD having to do with a double hit, a second wave infection. That just came out this morning, and it actually, I think, hit. Markets did not take it well in Europe this morning. We're going to take a quick look at COVID-19 around the world. We have some political news, as always, even more colorful than Donald Trump as Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, which I can't believe. I can't believe that story. That's amazing. So I can't wait for you to talk about that one. There's a story out of Taiwan. President Trump's curious recall of troops from Germany. And yes, we are going to do more on the George Floyd demonstrations. We're going to take a look at what the data say about the public's reaction, how it is hurting the president, and it is indeed hurting the president, and how these demonstrations are different from earlier waves of protests over racial injustice that we have seen in America. All of that and more. I have to say, and I want to say this before we go further, and that is to just pause briefly and remind all our listeners about what I'm trying to do on this podcast. I am trying to analyze events by bringing data to bear where I can and looking at historical parallels where I can. I'm doing this all in order to try to understand what is likely to happen. I'm interested in the future. I'm interested in where events are going. And I think I have to just emphasize this. I am not trying to side with any party or position. I'm not trying to criticize one side or bring support to another. And I think I have to say this because it's hard to discuss many issues today. And my God, Christian, we talk about nearly anything and everything on this show without some listeners think I'm siding with them or siding against them. So let me say again, I'm not siding with anybody. I'm never trying to offend anyone. I try my best to be respectful to all points of view. And I do have to say, if I sometimes offend, I must be an equal opportunity offender because I get flack here and there from both sides. And that's probably because I have listeners from very different viewpoints who follow this show. So my advice to all listeners is this: just be patient and understand that my own personal purpose in doing this podcast is to listen, learn, evaluate, and predict. It is not to judge. We live in such a passionate cancel culture today that sometimes it seems like no one has time for this. If you do have a question about something I said or what I meant in some podcast, please just email me at qadomography@hedgeye.com and just ask me. I'll try to answer. My personal feelings toward whatever I'm talking about are probably not all that different from yours. It occurred to me, Christian, that I may be asking something that actually runs against our historical forecast. We obviously have a lot of fourth turning readers, and one thing we certainly have predicted going into the 2020s was increasingly tribal culture, right? Increasing political polarization. So maybe there may be fewer and fewer readers left who are willing to just look at things without necessarily taking sides. We just got an interesting instance of this last week. Two senior editors, one on the Philadelphia Inquirer, the other in the the editorial page editor of the New York Times, was fired by basically having an op-ed that offended or you know, ran against the grain of many of their leaders. It's interesting. This is when I talk about cancel culture. I mean, that's kind of what I'm talking about. We're probably going to see, and again, I just take an analytical viewpoint on. I think we're going to see more of this. I just think it's inevitable. I think that's where a generational aging is taking us. So, with that preamble. Let's go into the market overview. Let's get back to our usual track and look at where markets took us this last week.
All right, Neil. Well, over the last six trading days, the S&P 500 is up 5% and the global Dow is up 6.8%. So you have global markets beating out the U.S.
once again.
And as for volatility, the VIX closed yesterday at 27.53. And for the last few weeks, it's been hovering in that high 20 range.
Right. It's interesting. The most of the technical indicators, certainly, and the immediate economic indicators, if you're really interested in the next 5 or 10 trading days, I think are positive for the market. Credit spreads have been declining. The U.S. dollar is in its third week of steady decline, which is good for U.S. exporters, and it's good for emerging markets, that makes it easier for them to survive whatever, you know, debt problems they now have. The yield curve is under strict Fed control. They're allowing the long end to rise slightly over the past couple of days. And we just had the FOMC meeting release its statement this afternoon, and it looks like they intend to be strictly in control. And they are asking, we're going to come back to this soon. They're asking, obviously, like every other central banker around the world, they're asking Congress, they're asking government to step in and actually do more fiscally because we don't want to have to do everything through monetary policy. Commodities are rising again. Gold is stabilized. And VIX, although heading back up a little bit over this last day or two, still remains in the mid to high 20s, hugely below what it was. So there you got it. I have to mention, by the way, that the NBR, officially declares February as the peak of the business cycle. So lo and behold, we finally have a recession. So everyone knows that this is done, right? Once NBR declares a peak, that means what follows is going down, right? So March becomes the first month of recession. Now, I have to say, this is the most unsurprising NBER announcement. It's like, did anyone in the world, right, have any question that March would be an official, you know, officially the recession month? And I just have to remind people how different that is from so many earlier recessions. The recession of 2001, as I recall, was not finally declared by the NBER until almost the next recession. I think it was 2006 before they finally decided. The late Marty Feldstein, as I recall, kept insisting that, and he was, you know, the big mover and shaker at the NBR, insisting, no, it must have started in the final quarter of 2000, because that's when Bill Clinton was still president, you know. So anyway, partisanship isn't new, is it? Anyway, but that argument wasn't resolved for several years. We've often had long controversies about when recessions start. No controversy here. This has got to be the earliest time I have, you know, anyone has ever seen a recession declared. So there you got it. Now to the bad news. The bad news is just continuing bad economic numbers. So even though the markets actually look good near term, sooner or later, the markets and all of us are going to have to contend with continuing disturbing economic numbers, and also with the almost certain resurgence of infection rates as economies begin to open back up. And we'll say a couple of things about that later. But first, Christian, maybe you can take us through, I don't know, whatever economic numbers there are.
Yes. So last week we got another round of initial unemployment claims, which was at 1.9 million. And that brings us to 42.6 million unemployment claims since the end of March, Neil. No small number.
Wow.
And we also got for...
Yeah.
I was just going to say, we got for May, we have the non-farm payroll, and we added 2.5 million jobs. Now, that might seem like quite a few jobs, but remember in April, we lost 20.7 million.
Yeah, and that's the non-farm payroll numbers. Those are the right. Establishment numbers. If you look at the household survey numbers, so this is the kind of the census household survey numbers. We currently have 137 million employed in May. That's up slightly from 133 million in April. It's up 4 million, but even 137 million in May, you have to go all the way back to October of 2000 before you can find another month in which so few Americans were working. I find that staggering. You have to go back almost 20 years. That's how much growth we've seen taken out, even after that rebound. Now, as for the unemployment number, it came in at 13.3%, but a lot of that was, as the census itself admitted, was miscounting. And due to some odd accounting, and I think you can see that by just juxtaposing two obvious numbers. Continuing benefits, I mean, people just ongoing continuing benefits on unemployment is 30 million workers. But only 21 million workers are counted as officially unemployed. Well, that already raises an interesting question, right? I mean, if they're getting unemployment insurance benefits, how can they? I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm asking a stupid question, Christian. You can answer that. The technicalities of that. How does that work? But basically, if you counted all those 30 million workers who are collecting unemployment insurance benefits, including those gig workers and so on, who wouldn't ordinarily be insured for that, you would not be at 13.3%, but you'd be somewhere up around 19%. And by the way, that was the expectation of economists, that we'd be up at around 19%. So what do you see abroad?
All right, well, if we go over to Europe, Germany had its balance of trade surplus come in for April. Now, the March number for this, Neil, was 17.4 billion. April, it dropped to 3.5 billion.
We're talking
This
about
is its smallest.
euros, right?
Yes,
Yeah,
we're talking about
euros.
euros.
Got
And
it.
this is its smallest surplus since 2000.
Right.
So,
That's
3.5
amazing.
to 17.4,
And if it had
huge
been
drop
a
there.
little bit more, it would have been running a trade deficit. Now, this is an
Right.
economy that I think is synonymous with practically everyone in the world with export-led. The adjective export-led always goes before the phrase German economy, right? I think
Yes.
so. And it exports to everyone, and it even loves to delight in the surplus of exporting to the rest of Europe, which obviously does not please the rest of Europe. Okay. What else have you got?
Well, if we go over to Asia, China had some numbers, the Shenzhen services PMI and composite PMI for May. Services were at 55 and composite was at 54.5. Now, this is the first growth we have seen since January. And they say most of this has been spurred from internal demand has been going up. Why it's still so low around that 50 range is that obviously as COVID takes over the world, external demand is still quite low.
Yeah, well, I can imagine. And that's since January, and this is
Yeah.
these are May numbers, right? So,
Right.
wow. It'll take a lot of 55s in a row before they before they get back up to before they where they were, right?
Right.
That's a rather modest acceleration. But at least it's positive. I mean,
Right.
and that actually brings me to the next thing I was going to talk about. This is a report this morning from the OECD, and they kind of call it the double hit scenario. So they actually came out with their estimates of the year-over-year GDP decline in 2020. So this is basically the entire year's GDP in 2020 versus 2019, right? Year-over-year. And the numbers are just staggering. The euro area hit the worst of all the regions they look at, minus 9.1%, OECD at minus 7.5%, US at minus 7.3%, the entire world at minus 6%. I don't think even the 2009 recession ever caused a year-over-year decline in world GDP, particularly because China was still growing fairly strongly. China, by the way, the OECD expects to decline by minus 2.6% year over year. And that's their single hit scenario. I won't read the double hit scenarios, but they're all about 2 to 3 percentage points worse. Well, I don't know. 1 to 2 to 3 percentage points worse. So that was not good news. That was not good news for a market sort of looking for, continuing momentum on, the huge new fiscal deal that Europe's been proud of, and kind of the momentum in Europe, and nor, as it turned out, was it terribly favorable here in America with the equity markets. Meanwhile, the Fed did come in. I think the Fed actually on net probably pleased investors. They just remain as adamant about continuing on current course, nailing down that yield curve to the floor, and nothing's going to budge them. This brings us to the second main point, I guess the other bit of bad news, and that is the forecast of infection rate growth. As many of our listeners know, kind of tracking this pandemic, we measure its exponential growth rate through something called R-naught. If it's above one, it means it's exponentially growing. And it turns out that according to one of the leading institutes, the EPA forecast in London actually calculates this for every country, it is growing now in most of the world. Now, it is not growing in most of Europe, which remains pretty much locked down or contained. The only exceptions here are currently Portugal and Sweden. And we all know the story of Sweden, kind of the outlier here. But so many areas of the world beyond that are now rising again. That includes the United States, Mexico, almost all of Latin America, Christian, with the exception of Peru. Brazil looks terrible right now, and Argentina, which used to look not so bad, is looking terrible. All of the Mideast, South Asia, that includes, you know, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, and then Russia certainly is out of control and moreover not even measured. Asia remains pretty good. East Asia are probably our poster child for, you know, successful containment, with the exception of Indonesia. But my point is that this large growth in the emerging markets and in the United States is going to play out because these people are increasingly going back to work. And whatever other protective measures they take, I think we're going to see infection rates growing again. This is exponential. So at first you don't see it much, but then it begins to build momentum over time, right? And we also see it state by state, increasing number of states. I mean, we cover this list every Thursday on our show. So I think you're going to have to deal with that. Now, there is one piece of good news we're going to talk more about next Thursday, and that is the beginning of evidence of a declining death rate. This first came out with news from some Italian doctors who said last week that the virus is losing energy. That was their word for it, you know, becoming less vital. And that struck most biologists as odd. You know, a virus isn't even really a living thing. I mean, how can it lose energy? You know, I mean, it's just, you know, the DNA is just a molecule sitting there. But one thing now that a couple of pre-publication studies have come out is that apparently there really has been a fairly substantial decline in the death rate from March to April, as measured by two different sets of researchers in Italy. And I think you're seeing evidence of this around much of the world, and this is good news. And in Italy, it's been as much as a 40% decline, especially among the very old and those with pre-existing conditions. And the reason is not any miracle cure, but a lot of little things. They're giving patients HIV, antivirals, remdesivir, you know, from Gilead. They're giving them anti-inflammatories and immunosuppressors, you know, to prevent the cytokine storm that so many of these patients get. Tocilizumab is a favorite one there. Anticoagulants, as we begin to understand the role of this virus in causing, you know, alternatively excessive bleeding and excessive coagulation. Coagulation is probably the most dangerous around the body. Less use of ventilators, even simple things like turning patients onto their stomach rather than onto their back. The sum total of all these things, Christian, is causing a little things. You know, a lot of them are little things, all mm-hmm. at the margin, is causing a really significant decline in the death rate. I think this is great. I remember when this thing first came out, my reaction was, you know, I don't want to be an early patient to get sick. By the time I get sick, I want to go see a doctor who's seen 500 patients like me before. You know, right. and I think we're beginning to benefit from that. Again, you know, the vaccine, the miracle cure. I mean, I keep talking to doctors about this. This is still way out there. There's so many hurdles. Both in the discovery and making sure it's safe and manufacture and so on before that will be widespread. But anyway, there you have it. The biggest question to me right now in looking at the U.S. economy is the combination of accelerating infection rates with the end of fiscal stimulus. All of this is going to come to an end. The PPP is going to be running out this month, early next month. Obviously, the unemployment benefits is completely run out at the end of July. Congress right now doesn't want to pass any more stimulus. And I think it's going to be really interesting what happens, particularly in July, when everyone is staring at the end of the road, right? I mean, it's kind of like a highway that just suddenly comes to an end. and everyone's going to see us hurtling toward that point. And there's going to be a lot of brinkmanship. I think the Democrats are going to put together a bill which is huge on benefits to workers, and they don't want it going necessarily to Wall Street. Just given the Senate and its usual proclivities, they're going to be saying, no, we need indemnity protection for big businesses. We got to make sure that these big businesses are well taken care of. And then you have Trump. And I wouldn't be surprised if this is either going to end up in a massive car collision crash and with nothing happens, or Trump is just going to say, you know, Trump is more focused on the stock market even than Jerome Powell. And that's saying something. And he's just going to be saying, this is totally going down. And I am absolutely going down unless we do anything to turn this around. So I wouldn't be surprised if Trump just says, let's just okay everything that both sides have. Give the Democrats everything they want. Give the Republicans everything they want. You know, let's add another $3 trillion onto the national debt, and we'll think about how to pay for it later. I don't know. And if it ever gets inflationary, well, we'll just count on the Fed to do the right thing if that happens. Anyway, it's going to be a very interesting time, I think, on national policymaking in that time frame, particularly when you can imagine infections rising, and how are we going to deal with that? Much less the whole problem of the OECD scenario, the second wave this fall. But anyway, that's the United States. I do know we wanted to cover a couple of countries around the world, so maybe we could go there.
Well, it seems every week something new is happening in Brazil, Neil, and they did not disappoint this week.
All right.
Over the weekend, Bolsonaro took down the government website reporting COVID-19 cases and deaths. And this was all very mysterious. And a couple days later, the website came back online. But all the previous data was erased. It was gone. And Bolsonaro's come out and he claims that the states were giving him false data to make him look bad and try to tarnish his image. So he is erased all of that data, and he's starting over, and he's going to use a new method for counting.
I think Jair deserves data that makes him look good, don't you? I mean, why not? All right. Fascinating. So how's that going to be resolved?
So as of now, a judge has said that he has to post the old data in 48 hours. It's not clear if he's going to follow the judge or not. You know, he's been having a lot of issues with judges on countless different charges. And
yeah,
who knows what's going to happen with this. But I know some newspapers have started tabulating their own data, and they're putting that out saying, use ours, don't use the government website. It's not truthful anymore. But who knows how this has got to change.
Well, I think we're going to have another Lavo Jato, another car wash. I don't think he's going to last the end of the term increasingly. But, you know, impeachment does seem to be the way recent Brazilian presidents have exited office, right? And the infection rate is out of control. I mean, I just, every time I go and look at Brazil's numbers, they just look horrible. So.
And his popularity among the people is very low, and whenever they do polls, so he doesn't even have.
Yeah,
he doesn't have much.
By the way, the other interesting thing about it too is that it kind of tests the proposition that warm and humid weather retards the virus. Now it is true that it's beginning to get, particularly in southern Brazil, you know, beginning to get a little cooler, but it remains. Last time I checked the weather there, pretty hot and pretty humid in a lot of Brazil, and it doesn't seem to be helping them very much. Okay, so what's happening in Germany?
Well, this was kind of came out of the blue, but President Trump announced that he will be reducing the U.S. troop presence in Germany by one third. Now, right now, there's about 35,000 troops stationed there, and he just kind of came out of the blue and said this. Now, there has been, Neil, you might be able to talk about this a little bit more. There's always been some kind of back and forth between Trump and Germany about how much they give to NATO and whether the U.S. is doing too much when they're doing too little. And this seemed to be he's putting his money where, or his mouth where his money is.
Yeah, well, look, the United States has always spent a lot more on defense. You know, back in the early 60s, the United States spent over 10% of GDP on defense. And obviously, Europe spent a lot less. Now, the United States spends a lot less, and Europe spends even less. Right? I don't know that this has changed very much. This is the ancient problem of the free rider. How do you get an ally who can just basically depend upon the fact that the big power is going to spend whatever it takes? It is an issue, and Trump has raised it. I think this is a very bad time to bring it up. I think it's kind of pointless. I don't know what he gains by this, but it does say one thing, a real change in the constituency of each party. I think a Trumpified Republican Party, kind of a more populist Republican Party, is more isolationist. And the big surprise to me when I look at the polls is that the populist Republicans are becoming significantly more isolationist and more averse to use of force abroad than Democrats. And I think this surprises a lot of people. One bellwether poll that I look at is, this is one, I think it's the Council on Foreign Relations or someone's been doing it for the last 10 years, and it's basically asking Americans the question, if Estonia or, you know, one of the Baltic states is a NATO member gets, you know, invaded by Russia, should the United States, honor its NATO obligations and go to war in response? So what they found was, is that for the first time, conservatives, obviously mostly Republicans, are less likely to say they, think we ought to risk armed conflict to honor the obligations than Democrats. And this is a real flip from what a lot of us remember growing up, that the Republicans were always the one who supported an active and a strong military and a strong role for the United States abroad. This is really switching. And I think when we look at issues like China and the pivot to Asia and so on, we often assume that things are more dangerous or more likely to escalate to war or a hard line be taken under a Republican presidency. That assumption, too, I think is no longer correct. And I think when we've talked about some of the other issues on the world, such as China, we've talked a little bit about the changing positions of the two parties on that. But anyway, as I understand it, the Germans themselves are about 50-50 on U.S. pulling troops out, but Americans are about 85% in favor that these bases are important. Is that right?
Right. This was a Pew poll, and they found that 85% of Americans say that these German bases are somewhat or very important. But as you said, in Germany, only 52% say the same thing. So it's kind of a weird position for me with Trump that Americans on the broad actually support these German troops in Germany.
Yeah, but he thinks, they're taking advantage of us and, they're chiseling us out of money. They should be spending more. Trump's position is always bargain hard with everybody. friends as well as enemies. They're all trying to chisel you out of money, right? Okay. The final little episode, which I thought was very interesting, this concerns in Taiwan. This is Han Kuo-yu, who's the mayor of Kaohsiung. And what's really interesting is he belongs to the Kuomintang Party, and he ran against Tsai Ing-wen for the presidency last year. Now, as we covered that, Tsai Ing-wen won the presidency of Taiwan. She's very pro-Taiwanese independence, and she won a surprisingly large victory. The Kuomintang was certainly distressed by their defeat. But what's interesting was with the increasing movement of the Taiwanese people to a hard line on China, That last week, he was ousted from his office as mayor by a heavy majority in a recall vote by local Taiwanese residents. And his main offense was continuing to call for reconciliation with China. His motto during the campaign with Tsai Ing-wen was, "Safety for Taiwan, money for the people." That kind of sounds like being a Quisling, doesn't it? Selling out, you know, so we got the lucre. Anyway, that's suddenly a very unpopular position. I think it speaks to the rapidly hardening positions toward China in Taiwan as they watch the fate of Hong Kong under so-called one country, two systems. And as I've said before, I think Hong Kong is a sleeper of an issue, which doesn't allow many easy ways to back down for both sides. And we're going to kind of see where that goes. So, well, this brings us to the last issue we want to talk about, returning all the way back to the United States. It's been on a lot of people's minds lately. We talked about it last week. We've issued, I don't know, Christian, maybe three or four different reports on different aspects of it. And those are the George Floyd protests. And one thing I wanted to report on, we're beginning to get data now on how people feel about it. A recent Monmouth University survey found an interesting observation. And you know, like most things, it's the first thing I learned about surveys a long time ago. Most people have mixed feelings about things. You know, we don't just have one feeling about something. And what they found is that most Americans, 57%, agree that the anger of protesters is justified. Another 21% say that their anger is partially justified. There's a large agreement that there is a problem with, you know, police in particular, racial attitudes to African Americans among people who enforce the laws in general. And it's a serious problem. On the other hand, the polls also showed that when it came to the actions of the protesters, right, that's where you get this a little bit of a split. 37% say they're partially justified, or quote unquote, only partially justified, and 38% say they're not justified at all. You know, and it's hard to know exactly what they mean by protesters. Are you talking about violent protesters or just simply protesters in general, you know, simply people who are exercising their, you know, First Amendment right to demonstrate, right? So as usual, there's a spectrum of opinions. President Donald Trump thought this was big enough for him to ram a wedge, and he has tried to play that last group. He's tried to say, okay, well, people are scared of violence. I'm going to play that one. And it really has not been working for him. He is his approval ratings have really taken a hit. After a brief surge in late March, due to, you know, some rally around the flag a little bit after the pandemic crisis, which was up to 47.7. They're now down to 42.6. That's pretty big. That's a 5 percentage point decline. It's hard to win in 2020 if you're sitting there around 42%. Doubling down on your base is not a winning strategy. I mean, getting fewer and fewer people more and more amped up on your behalf. I don't know about you. It just doesn't seem like the way you're gonna win a second term. The predicted, which is the futures market that we often look at, is now 60% to 42% in favor of the Democrats winning the White House. That's the largest lead the Democrats have had. And in the opinion of most forecasters, you know, 538 and Cook Analytics, a lot of these companies, Senate control now is a toss-up. Everyone used to think that GOP will retain control of the Senate. Now people are thinking it could go either way. Remember that in 2020, because of the huge gains the GOP made in 2014, the GOP are defending 23 seats. The Democrats are only defending 12 seats. And of all those seats, only one is leaning, only one Democratic seat is leaning to the GOP, and that's Doug Jones in Alabama. But you have about eight states which have Republican senators who are now leaning Democratic or are complete toss-ups, and that includes Arizona, Montana, your state of Maine. You know, we'll see whether she retains that seat. You see Iowa, Georgia, Kansas, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Colorado, and a lot of, you know, a lot of prominent Democrats are trying to take the sitting Republicans from 2014 on in this race. So much for Trump. He has not fared at all well in America's response to these protests, and I think simply because he's doubled down on authority, and as I suggested last week, he has no vision of community whatsoever. But let me come back to the George Floyd presentations. We did a couple of reports last week where, and in one of them, and I believe I talked a little bit about that last week, I said the one underlying condition that has allowed these protests to strike such a wide chord of agreement with most Americans that policing is needs to be more tolerant and less brutal and often less racially biased is the fact that we have seen a large decline in violence in America. And it takes a little bit of historical perspective to realize that. But if you look back and you look at, you know, what Kamala Harris and Joe Biden and all those guys were doing back in the mid-1990s, they were not saying, you know, go lighter on policing. And that was because it was a very different era and people were facing a very different reality, a rate of violent crime that was nearly four times as large back then. And I think this has led to a new climate on justice reform, and we've seen some of it. We saw one of it, which is bipartisan. It was the One Step Act, which stepped down prison terms for a lot of nonviolent crimes for federal prisoners. And we now have some survey numbers from 538 and Pew on this as well, and that is there's been a shift in white and Hispanic opinion on injustice to African Americans with policing that really started in 2015. It's been spearheaded by the young, by the educated, obviously by Democrats, but it has drawn along older and GOP as well. You do actually see some of the older and GOP lines, obviously much lower, but beginning to rise as well in agreement with this position. And you even see clearly, I mean, even in the Republican Senate and a number of senators trying definitely to differentiate themselves from the president on this. And this led us to some observations on what is different about the George Floyd demonstrations from a lot of, you know, what's often been called, you know, racial unrest in America that we've seen, you know, back in 1992, back in the long hot summers of the late 1960s, 64 through 67. One striking difference, and this has been pointed out by a number of people, is the substantial participation of white Americans in the George Floyd demonstration, spreading even to mostly white demonstrations in small town America, which I've certainly never seen before, and I don't think anyone's really seen before. I think this is striking. And again, I think that means it reflects a large, a new consensus on this issue. It also reflects not only white agreement with the demonstrators' goals, but the largely peaceful behavior of the protesters and the fact that so many more affluent whites live in urban areas, right? I mean, just think of what's happened over the past 15 years. Because millennials of all races are committing so much less violence in cities today, many more millennials of all races have chosen to live in cities, even affluent millennials who could afford to live anywhere else. So footnote on that, Christian, I used to live in New York, downtown New York in the early to mid 1980s. And I go to New York today, and it is a completely different city in terms of not just the fact of violence, but just the feeling of disorder. Very different today, a different world today. The difference in violence, again, is the key. And I think I alluded to this last time, you know, the 1992, you know, quote unquote unrest in South Central LA, it was horrific. And it required not just the National Guard, but U.S. federal troops coming in before that thing was finally, you know, was finally terminated. No one who didn't live there would ever think of actually going there. Right. So this, it's not like, you know, a demonstrators actually think of like going to that neighborhood to participate in that protest. That was definitely not going on back then, but it's definitely happening today. And I think that strikes to a big points to a big difference. Another big difference, and this is a topic raised in a recent New York Times article, which I thought was very perceptive, is the location of the George Floyd demonstrations. Historically, African-American demonstrations and protests sparked by acts of injustice have occurred mainly within African-American communities. This time, there has been little or no unrest in poor, mostly black urban neighborhoods. You know, I'm talking about like Watts, Oakland, South Chicago, the South Bronx. Instead, the demonstrators have deliberately targeted many of the whitest and most affluent census tracts in each city. Rodeo Drive in L.A., Miracle Mile in Chicago, the new downtown in Detroit, Soho in New York, you know, Buckhead in Atlanta. You can just go around and look at where these are. And I think you're asking why, and I think it's the two reasons. It's fair to point out that these ritzy neighborhoods are not as white as they used to be, thanks to a rising generation of affluent non-white professionals. But I think it's also true that the protest leaders decided that to get their point across, it makes sense to go to where they'll be noticed, go to where the wealth and power are. And in this, I think there's a further rationale. I mean, if you're totally trying to explain this, and I've written about this often, and that is the growing social tension generated by skyrocketing economic inequality in America's major urban centers. I don't know. I can't even remember the titles of some of the pieces, Chris. You probably remember, but it is extraordinary. Rents are so high, property values are so high that increasingly low-income workers can't even live there. And we see this Gini coefficient, however you measure it, there's this breaking apart from the most, you know, major affluent centers, particularly on the coast, from every other major city in America. And also consider how this inequality has been worsened by the pandemic lockdown, right, which has clearly penalized people who are young and poor and, service workers, people who are out of a job if they can't go outside and be in contact with other people. So the way I see it is, if windows are to be smashed and stores looted, why not make sure they include Nordstrom and Apple and REI, and, you know, all these people that we see, you know, these places we see in the newsreels that serve the affluent and that pay most of their employees very little. And many of those employees may be the demonstrators. I think there's a certain inner logic to this. The protest movement is focused on, you know, Black Lives Matter, but it's also drawing energy from 1%. And I think what you're going to see is these two movements beginning to merge. A growing number of young whites and Latinos whose lives are on hold may be finding it easier to identify with an historically disadvantaged minority across the board. And in this sense, you know, no matter what you think about police reform, I Can't Breathe is probably a harbinger of a lot more to come. And I think it's an interesting indicator of where I find us going in the 2020s, kind of looking ahead. You know, what this will actually do for policy reform is another matter. One similarity, by the way, of the George Floyd demonstrations with you know, hashtag Me Too, you know, it was a seemed to be dominate the headlines a couple of years ago with Harvey Weinstein and, you know, all of the media around that. Most Americans also agreed with regard to sexual harassment, particularly in the workplace. Most Americans agree it's a big problem. But when you ask them, what do you do about it? it's you don't get much agreement. It's like everyone agrees it's this huge, deep-seated social cultural problem. What do we do about it? Well, it's unclear, you know, other than just live a completely different way, right? It's unclear what the policy reform is. You see a little of that same dilemma here around racial injustice. Now, clearly, reform in particular of police practices is right up there at the top of the agenda. One problem that I see with that being pursued by the Democrats is kind of a peculiar one, an ironic one, is one of the problems with police governance is extremely decentralized. I mean, every municipality sort of has their own police force, and its governance is dominated by the power of police unions. So here you have a little bit of irony here. It's hard to get the Democrats to take a huge swing at public sector unions, right? Despite the fact that these unions have historically blocked any kind of rational reform of practices. And in fact, it's usually the unions that are behind a lot of these practices whereby, you know, you don't even cooperate with prosecutors if the prosecutor asks to go after a policeman, right? You understand? I mean, police have to have the cooperation of prosecutors to go after criminals. So you can see how the unions call the shots. Well, you know, I mean, who's against public sector unions? Well, maybe, you know, Calvin Coolidge and Ronald Reagan, but not many Democrats. You see, there's a little bit of a tension there. The main idea that's...
Neil, I have a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, with police departments being localized, do you think that these reforms are going to have... Are they going to come from Washington, or are they going to be more on the local level?
Well,
state government?
Yeah, I'm getting to that. I'm wending my way to that one. I'm wending my way to that one. The one idea that you have seen, you know, particularly, I think, a little bit you could say on the left, although it seems to be a kind of a main idea that's being implemented in Minneapolis, is this so-called defunding of the police, or maybe just dismantling the police, which actually in principle, I don't even think is necessarily a bad idea. I think it's sometimes good to actually take an institution, break it apart, and try to build it again, particularly if it seems very dysfunctional in its inner workings. We have the great example of Camden, New Jersey, who's basically just disbanded its police force, completely retrained them all from scratch, and is regarded as highly effective and doing one of the things that I think everyone agrees that police forces need to do, which is integrate the delivery of social services with the delivery of, you know, the brute force of an occupying army. I mean, that's kind of the problem here, right? And I think one problem that defunding has as simply a strategy It's very antagonistic. It's basically, you know, we want to basically demote the police. We either want to, I don't know, employ less of them or train them less or just spend money on them and instead deliver social services. I think that's a bad mistake, and I don't think many Americans would really feel comfortable with that. I think what many Americans would want is, why can't social services work together with police, right? Why can't you integrate them?
Right.
Why don't you give social service people more authority and then make policemen a little bit, you know, take away some of their authority? I mean, why does it have to be one or the other? I mean, does everything in America have to be, you know, my solution versus your solution? I think the exercise of authority and a little bit of paternalism around a lot of troubled people, particularly those with drug problems, those who are in hard up neighborhoods, those who have mental illness problems and so on, you need some authority with social services, and that may be a big just shift in how we even exercise public policy. One of the issues I find is that when you deal with dysfunctional communities, but your attitude is everyone's a sovereign individual and I can't touch them or do anything until they commit a crime, well, then it's hard for social services to get started, really. And it's hard for police to act in any other way except, you know, we're coming in once, you know, someone's in fear of his life. But anyway, that in itself may be a deep-seated change. I think that in response to this call for defunding, I think, first of all, I just should mention off the top that the Black Caucus in Congress has disavowed the idea. They're not in favor of defunding. Joe Biden has disavowed the idea. Kamala Harris, you know, who knows? Kamala Harris may become Joe Biden's vice presidential nominee, you know, with him. But they've all disavowed it. And I think on the Black Caucus side, a lot of it just has to do with the fact that they represent constituents who actually live in those neighborhoods. And although we might talk about violence down overall in America, a lot of these are communities that are plagued by violence. And the last thing they want is someone to simply say, you know, we're going to pull our police out. That's just not an answer for these people. You know, just to give you an instance, this just happened just a few days ago. This was on May 31st. In one day, 18 people were gunned to death in separate incidents in South and West Chicago. That's in one day. So, you know, these people too have rights. You know what I mean? They too deserve justice. And just simply say I'm against police or I want to somehow disempower them, that in itself is not the most constructive solution. What you want is the police that will be reformed, that will function better, that will work with all kinds of auxiliary services and really deliver the kind of care and justice that we all want. I think Joe Biden was very good at disavowing that idea. I think that was a great way to differentiate himself with Trump. Not, you know, Trump is moving to his right. Joe Biden says, no, I'm not going totally to my left on this. And I think that was smart for him. I think that will position him better for the election coming up. If you just want to talk about politics, there is a compromise solution, which I thought was a pretty good piece of legislation introduced by the Democrats in the House called the Justice and Policing Act, which would limit police legal protections. It would create a database of excessive force incidents. It would ban police chokeholds. And obviously, it has little chance in the Senate. But I think it may help Democrats. I really think the Democrats, and this is just, again, this is my analysis. This isn't, you know, necessarily my feeling. I'm just saying, I think Democrats are helped when they support moderate, mainstream pieces of legislation that strike everyone as very reasonable. And even when they force Republicans to oppose it, I think they help themselves. I thought they did. They've been doing that on gun control, and I think they could do a very good job. Here. So, in summation, why the George Floyd demonstrations now? I think we've looked at some of the reasons. Declining overall violence in America, I think, has been an important background element in the widespread American support for this movement. As I've indicated before, this follows a long-term historical pattern of people believing we should emphasize more justice and fairness to individuals who are having police action taken against them during periods when people feel more confident that violence isn't the central problem in their lives. We can in some sense afford to be just. I think another one is, as I mentioned, this growing alliance of Black Lives Matter with 1%, and I think urban inequality is in focus. And I think given this, you know, second great recession, I don't know what we're going to call it. We're going to call it a greater recession. Maybe that'd be good. Yeah. We'll call it the greater recession. Anyway, is going to be an issue. And one last thing I want to point out, and that was actually a story we just had, and that was a fascinating new article in JAMA. That's the Journal of the American Medical Association, that the share of adults reporting symptoms of serious psychological distress has hugely jumped in April compared to, you know, March or February or earlier due to the shutdown. And this was a substantial. They used what's called a Kessler survey, and Kessler asked a bunch of questions to determine a respondent's level of psychological distress. Things like how many times have you felt nervous in the last 30 days and so on. And it turns out that the baseline was, for instance, in April of 2018, was 3.9%. This last month in April, it was 13.6%. So what is that? That's a 3 to 4 times jump. The biggest increase was among the young, and among lower-income people. The dramatic increase occurred, the most dramatic increase occurred in young adults, who saw an eightfold rise from 3.7% to 24% who earned that threshold score on the Kessler 6 survey. For race, Hispanics had the biggest jump, and by wealth, low Americans. You're really talking about who has been most impacted by the shutdown, right? Economically, who has most lost their jobs, and who has most economic uncertainty? The young, non-whites, and people with less education. So that's what they found. And I think that might also say something about why everyone wants to get out and vent a little bit. I certainly feel that way. How about you, Christian? You want to get outside? And I don't know. I felt that way occasionally. I'm actually happy being at home, but there are times when I, it gets to me a little bit. But let me before we wrap this up, maybe you're a millennial. I'm just curious how you see that, particularly the two questions: the psychological distress. I found that difference in age to be very striking. So I just wonder what you see among your friends, and also the link to the protests, the demonstrations over racial injustice.
Well, Neil, as a millennial, you can imagine I have many friends and acquaintances who are out there protesting. And I think during this pandemic, a lot of people felt very helpless. I think a lot of millennials were disappointed, as this is a time in their lives when they're young and they want to go out and do things. But they didn't always have that. They haven't had that opportunity with the pandemic. And I think they're fired up. They've had a lot of time to think. And now that these protests have happened, this is a way that they can put their energy out there.
Yeah,
and I think
I agree.
Young are going to vote in large numbers in this election. I've people that I know that have never been political that are posting on social media. I see them at protests, and there's a lot of anger out there, and I think it's going to be an interesting election.
Well, there will be. We already saw a big jump in 2016 and 2018 in the youth vote. I think that's going to continue. I do look forward to millennials being, eventually becoming a political powerhouse. I mean, God knows they have they have a generation just ahead of them, Gen Xers, which have never been particularly known for their participation in civic leadership. God knows we won't go into the numbers on that, but they're certainly there. And I think that's going to be, one thing where we look at the deepening of the fourth turning. And what's going on today on the headlines? It's fascinating to me, look forward to. And I, this is partly why we do this podcast, to sort of track how this is happening as it's going on. Well, I'm glad you gave that those observations. Optimistic as always. I would expect nothing less from a millennial. And, you can count on a boomer to talk about, have you ever seen it rain when the sun is shining? And count on a millennial to just talk about the sun is shining. So it's been great. Thanks you all for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged, and talk to you all again next week. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hedgeye.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at Hedgeye.com.